was in Twin Falls the past couple of days doing some outreach ministry work with the Mormons. Ryan and I, we drove out Wednesday and Thursday.
Atomic batteries to power. Turbines to speed.
Roger. Ready to move out.
This one lady, she really irate at me. She got out of the car, came up to me about 3 feet away. Why are you doing this? What are you doing? You're persecuting them. I'm just standing out here with a sign. That's persecution? It was a parking attendant. He's quoted in 1 Timothy 6:16. He said, I don't want to debate with you. I said, well, the Bible says. I said, what do you do with that? And he says, nothing you can say will change my testimony about Joseph Smith being a true prophet. Hey, no touchy on the grass. Don't touch the grass. Stay off the grass. Amen. Don't use the Mormon bathrooms.
Are there any other books you believe need to be in the Bible?
Yeah, the Book of Mormon, Doctrine and Covenant, Pearl of Great Price.
Why is it that we've got so many denominations that are just moving towards heresy?
Because we are trying to become God ourselves.
Wake the neighbors, get the word out.
Hey everybody, how you doing? Faith and Reason time. I am your host, Matt Slick. And this is an apologetics Christian show, and what we do here is we answer difficult questions, or at least I try to, teach Christian theology, debate with atheists, whatever it is, and we just have a good time talking. I like doing it. Now, hey, folks, you can reach me, 877-207-2276, toll-free number 877-207-2276. And if you want to get in via Skype, all you got to do is type in Faith and Reason. No spaces, just Faith and Reason. You can get in, we'll port you in. And that's it. A lot to talk about tonight. Let's get to Bob from New York. Hey, Bob, welcome to the show.
Hi, Matt. I've given you a week off from me.
What's up, man? What
by
you got?
The way, I put up links about you so people can hear you, and somebody writes up and says, you're a real master of the con job. Is that a new one for you, or have you been called that before?
Oh, that a lot worse.
Okay. I have a question about prophecy in general that it's settled in my mind about Jesus fulfilling the prophecies, the messianic prophecies and all that, but I am not skilled enough to answer when somebody will say, oh, Those Jews they knew their Old Testament scriptures, and when they got around to writing the story of Jesus, they just plugged in stuff and said, look, he fulfilled a prophecy.
Oh, so they lied.
They kind of plucked it.
So they lied.
Yeah, that's what they're essentially saying.
Okay. So they're saying they lied, and I'd say, how do you know that? They're just saying it. Okay. So you're just accusing them of being liars, deceivers, because it obviously couldn't happen. And so that's what your assumption is. Your assumption needs to be tested, but then you just say it. How do you know that what you're saying is true? They just plugged it in. How do you know? Ask them. They're making an assertion. Ask them to validate their assertion. Not a big deal.
Okay. And how can I go a next step if they actually want to ask me, okay, how do I know that that didn't happen? I know I shouldn't be dignifying response.
How do you know it didn't happen? They're asking you to prove a negative.
That's
like you saying, show me there is no God. And they'll go, you can't do that. But they're two-faced a lot of times. So they'll ask you what they themselves would never consider answering. So you got to catch them on their logic and their issues. Now, look, let me tell you, when you talk to atheists, listen very carefully what it is they're asking, what it is they're stating. I remember I was talking to Kelly on the Rational Response Squad. She called me up three years ago, whatever. We were talking, and she said, for example, she's an atheist, and she said that atheism was a default position when babies are born. I said, how do you know that? She just stumbled. She had no clue how to answer that. How do you know that babies are born atheists? How do you know they're not born theists and have to learn how not to be atheists? How do you know? They will very often make assertions that don't have any validity whatsoever. So if they're going to make an assertion that simply it was a copying thing, a deception thing, they just want to make it look good, whatever it was, then ask them to validate it. And when they say, no, you have to validate something else. No. You're the one who made this assertion. Show your assertion to be valid. Just hold your feet to the fire, that's all. They'll call you names. They'll get rid of you. They'll say you're stupid. You don't understand anything. Blah, 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 blah. They'll call you all kinds of names. Oh, yeah, 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 you know. And they'll call you a con artist. And, you know, I've been called a con artist. I've been compared to Satan, Hitler, Bin Laden. I'm only doing this for money. What else? I'm obviously deceived, obviously deceiving people, obviously a liar.
Oh, and when somebody shoots down your arguments, you get whiny.
That's
somebody said that too.
Yeah, but when I shoot down their arguments, they're justified. You know, whatever. Atheists are the closest to Muslims I've ever seen. Muslims, you can prove them wrong. They don't care. They claim victory anyway. Doesn't matter what
just
you say.
Just like atheists.
Yeah. They're the same, you know, except one believes in God, one believes in a false God, and one believes in no God. And they both get up in the same place, eternal damnation. But, you know, it's just, I've had many debates with both sets of people, and they're the same. Doesn't matter what you say. They claim victory. They win. It's how it always is. That's what you call blindness. It's what we call brainwashing. Yeah.
And one time I had the opportunity to use exactly what you said. Somebody made the remark about infants are born atheists, and I said, how do you know that? You can't prove it. The guy went ballistic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And they will often accuse a great deal. And then, they'll still misread what you say, misread what you do, say you're whiny, say you got cornered, say whatever it is, blah, blah, blah. You know, I'll be in chat rooms. I like to talk to atheists. I know where they are. So I'll go to chat rooms, and they know who I am, and I'll get in there, and they'll say things like, now don't run, Matt, when it gets difficult. Right away, they'll say that, you know. And I kind of chuckle because they don't get difficult. And, you know, I just say, you guys haven't posed me any challenges yet. Come on, do it, you know. And I tweak them a little bit. And then, you know, I'll say, I have to go in a half hour. You know, my wife will be home. We're going to go to a movie, you know. And they'll say, oh, planning to run, huh? It doesn't matter what you say. You know, it's like, oh, brother. They're like, and I ask them, then I'll ask them, how old are you, 19? Are you a 19-year-old male whose frontal lobes aren't developed yet? You know, I have fun with them. Every now and then I'll meet a good one. You know, we can have a serious conversation. So, you know.
Yeah, I like the occasional serious ones, but mostly it's the undeveloped lobe people that I have to deal with.
Yeah, you know, it's I call it frontal lobe challenged. they don't
serious
like
affliction
that.
From Romans 1.
Oh, man. You know, and I will admit, I'll tweak them sometimes just for fun, because I get a little bored talking to the same old atheist. You know, you don't know what you're talking about, man. You're so stupid. Okay, thank you. And so I'll tweak them, you know, I'll just have a little fun, you know, say something that I know is going to get them going, you know, just say, you atheists are all alike, you all have the same philosophy. That's usually a good one. They just launch on that one. What do you mean we're all alike? We are not all alike. I'm laughing. I'll be behind my desk just laughing. Just go, what else can I say to tweak them, get them going, you know, it's fun. So they're so predictable, too. They are predictable. So,
but then you're not being a good Christian. Because
yeah, well, hey, who
mean.
Says? Who says I'm not being a good Christian?
They're whining.
They'll whine about everything. It doesn't matter what you say.
You can't win.
Yeah. You know, it's like this this guy called up a couple of days ago, the atheist guy, and you know, extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. And we talked about the reliability of the Bible and things like that. It was pretty good. And then we talked about this issue of the resurrection of Christ and the miracles require extraordinary evidence. Well, how do you demonstrate extraordinary evidence of a historical event? I mean, how do you do that? So I raised the issue of Alexander the Great. 33 years old, he'd conquered the Mediterranean world. That's an extraordinary claim. It really is, particularly back in that time, by the age of 33. Okay? Where's the evidence for it? A few things here and there, rather spurious. Okay, but he doesn't have any problem believing that. Well, that's different. You know, they have double standards. When you apply the same thing to them that they require of you, then you're the hypocrite. You don't really get it, et cetera, et cetera. It's just a perfect example of how utterly spiritually blind they are. It's incredible.
Or they won't accept the history of the New Testament, but they are willing to accept the writings of Julius Caesar. And how many manuscripts do we have of them? What, six?
Yeah, not very many, but they have no problem with Caesar. But the New Testament documents are incredibly more reliable, numerous, and accurate. But, no, we don't believe Jesus lived. You know, brother, okay. I didn't want to talk to them anymore. Why did you leave? You know, why? Well, because it can't happen. Okay, whatever. So.
You want to do a Homer Simpson? Boring!
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. And I do get bored with people now, more and more. Like, come on, been there, done that. Come on. You're boring me. Wasting my time. Give me a challenge. Atheists don't challenge me anymore. That's not to say that there aren't some that could. It's just that, generally speaking, they're not very much of a challenge. The three areas that comprise our world, you know, rationality, our origins, and morality, philosophical ramifications of each of these, they can't answer. They cannot deal with. And so all their comments and things basically end up in one or more of those categories.
Okay. I've been trying to get you some calls, and
it's all right.
A couple of my favorite atheist trolls that are on me, and one of them makes a remark, well, I live in Britain. Guess where he gets calls from? So that's no excuse.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's right. Okay, man. Well, hey, got any more? That's it?
Oh, I think I've given you enough. I got
right.
You going, right?
Yeah, atheists do that. And heretics and stuff like on Mary, which I talked on last night at this one church I was teaching. And we went through. People came to me afterwards and said, man, they had no idea what the Roman Catholic Church taught that much about Mary. I mean, it's stupendous. I may talk about it a little tonight. We'll see. Anyway, but that's that. Okay, buddy?
Okay, thanks a lot.
All right, man. God bless.
God bless.
All right. Hey, if you guys are interested in giving me a call, you can do that, you know. 877-207-2276. And if you want to get in via Skype, all you got to do is go to Skype. Type in Faith and Reason. No spaces, Faith and Reason. You should be able to get in. It looks like it's working. Let's get to Emily from Connecticut. Hey, Emily. Welcome to the show.
Hi.
Hi.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Hey, this is the first time I've been on the radio. I'm kind of nervous.
Ever?
Yeah.
You mean you're nervous because, like, thousands of people are listening?
Yeah.
Okay. It's okay. You're just talking to me. No big deal.
Okay.
I'll treat you nicely, okay?
Okay, thank you.
Okay.
I'm a friend of Nicole Vandeventer.
Oh, okay.
And, and she and I are having kind of this, like, long, epic Facebook discussion right now about a particular Bible verse, and we were both wondering if, like, you could settle something for us that we were discussing.
Mm-hmm.
Now, people often, when they say that the Bible is inerrant, and you ask them, you know, and like somebody asks, well, how do you know that? Usually people will say 2 Peter 1:20 through 21. And that's often called a quote-unquote proof text, as in kind of like a circular argument, as in sort of the it's true because it says it's true rationale. So I was wondering, like, how is it, you know, that we could know or explain to somebody that it's inerrant, like without you know, like using a proof text or what would be a circular argument?
Well, first of all, are you a Christian?
Yeah, I am.
Okay. Just so you know, very, very, very many people will use circular arguments, and it's not automatically wrong to use a circular argument. Now, people will say that.
Yeah.
And say, man, that doesn't make sense. Yes, it is. I'll explain. I say, see, look, logic is something that we all use, but how do you validate logic? If you use logic to validate logic, you're begging the question. You're using a circular argument. And so just because something is circular doesn't mean it's invalid. Well, the issue is truth needs to be weighed against reasoning and evidence. And so we can find out, because truth is a statement. Truth is not a condition, it's a statement about something. And so truth requires a mind. But at any rate, back to the issue of inerrancy. If the Bible is authored by God, and God himself is infallible, then it's logical to conclude that the original documents inspired by him would be without error. That's what inerrancy means, that the original documents, or what's called the autographs, are the documents that were inspired by God and are without error in everything that they teach. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So that's what that is. All right. It does not mean that the copies are perfect, because the copies are not perfect.
Yeah.
There are textual errors. There are. Not very many. They don't affect doctrinal issues, except maybe one at the end of Mark. I could make a case for that. But the New Testament is something like 99.5% textually pure. It's extremely accurate. But there are textual variants. There are. So the issue of inerrancy goes with the autographs, okay? Okay.
Okay, thank you.
Anything else?
No, that was basically it. But, like, I guess what that brings up is that, like, since certain things were changed over the years due to, like, errors in translation or, you know, mistakes that the people who were writing, who were, you know, copying it may have been making, like, even though the original scripts were inerrant, like, basically, I wonder, like, if we don't know exactly what they said, then...
Well, here's how it works. Here's how it works.
Yeah.
See, look, I could... what if I wrote you a letter? Well, let's just use this. We'll just use... John the Apostle wrote a letter called the Gospel of John. Now, that first copy is without error. Now, it's a very valuable document. The church recognized it, since it was John the Apostle who wrote this to the church, and it's about Jesus. I mean, Jesus is important, so people would copy it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the way they would copy things was very, very meticulous. Now, they have what's called gematria. What that means is that every word has a mathematical value in Greek. And the New Testament was copied in Greek. So they don't have alpha characters, nor do they have, they have alpha characters only, but they don't have a separate set of numeric characters like we do in English. So the letters were also numbers. So when they wanted to write a number one, they wrote the first letter of the Greek alphabet, which is alpha. The second letter, beta, would be a number two. So if they wanted to write, for example, the number 12, they would just do alpha, beta, and that would be the number 12.
Oh, okay.
So they understood that. Not a big deal. And so when they would write numbers, they would just use the characters, which are also numbers. Well, it just means then that when you write a word, it had a mathematical value. So if I might stretch it a little bit to make an illustration, if I were to write to you, you know, I owe you $100, right? It looks like the number 10. You could say, hey, there's a relationship there. That's how it is in Greek, except a little more precise. The whole point is that when they would copy documents, they would do it in a page form like we had. It was called a codice. They would take these lines and they would copy them letter by letter, not memory by memory, not word by word, but letter by letter. And they would, because they were doing it very, very carefully. And then once the page was done, they would add up the letters, which are also numbers, and then, you know, add up those columns. And if there was a discrepancy, then they got rid of the copy. And they would toss it, and they would start over again on that page. This is how it was done. It's extremely accurate. Well, what might happen is a copy might be sitting around for 100 years. And just because things get old, a little thing like a rough breathing mark, which is the H sound, which is essentially a comma over a letter, over a vowel. Well, that would mean then, you know, if that little thing flaked off, and someone copied it without that little rough breathing mark, because it's so small it could flake off, that would be called a variant. But they might know it might belong to the word hati, you know. And so they would know that that word requires a rough breathing mark. And they might, you know. So it, just stuff like that. And so when they would copy these things very, very carefully. Well, what if people made one copy on the left and one copy on the right, identical. And then the one on the left went 100 miles east, and the one on the right went 100 miles to the west. Well, back in those days, that's 200 miles distance difference. You don't just get on in a plane or a car and zip over to compare. they would be sitting there by themselves, basically isolated. And copies would be made out of those copies in those locations, which would be sent out and spread out all over the Mediterranean area. Well, what they can do is actually test. Now, they can test for the age of these documents, when they were written, the whole bit, where they were written, the style, the ink, the paper, everything. And they can pretty much build a case for which one came out of which copy, from which parent document. It goes on and on. They can reconstruct these things extremely well. And
yeah,
so do we amazing. Know what the, do we know what the originals were? Yes, we do.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Did that help?
Yeah, that helped a lot.
Okay, good. All right.
Yeah, I appreciate it.
Sure, no problem. Okay.
Have a good day.
All right, well, God bless. You too. Hey, folks, if you want to call, 877-207-2276. That's 877, toll-free number. And then 207-CARM, 207-CARM, C-A-R-M. CARM.org is my ministry, or I should say the one that the Lord has let me lead, found, do, Christian Apologetics Research Ministry, CARM.org. Please go and check it out. And, yeah, there it is. Okay. Hey, let's get to Paul from London. Paul, welcome to the show.
Hi, Matt. How you doing?
Doing all right, Paul. Buddy, how are you, man?
Good, good. I've been away from your show for a while, and I've come back and I've found that there's no video link, so I can't see your handsome face while I'm talking to you.
Well, that's because the camera has a handsome filter on it. It only lets handsome stuff in, and it kept getting a blank screen.
Ah, that would be it then.
Yes, it just didn't work.
Okay. Still loving the show. I got a quick question for you. Mm-hmm. It's about John 3:13.
Okay, John 3:13.
Basically, what I want to ask you is, given what the Old Testament says about Elijah and about Enoch, mm-hmm. what do we conclude from 3:13?
And that says, "And no one has ascended into heaven but he who has ascended from heaven, even the Son of Man."
Okay. Yeah.
Do you know that there's three heavens in Jewish yeah. cosmology?
Yeah.
Okay, for those who are listening, the first heaven is where the air is, the birds, the clouds, etc. The second heaven, where the planets, the stars, the moon is. The third heaven is God's dwelling place.
Right.
So no one is descended from heaven except the Son of Man. So since Jesus is divine, coming from God the Father, so to speak, well then, that's the heaven he's talking about.
But he said, but doesn't he say, hang on, he says no one has ascended to...
into heaven. He?
Mm-hmm. Hello?
Yes.
He says no one has ascended to.
Into heaven, yes. Into that third heaven.
Right, but he's speaking past tense here in this verse, isn't he?
Moses and Elijah did not go to heaven. They went up into the heavens. They were ascended up into the clouds, and they were taken, probably taken to Abraham's bosom.
Oh, okay. But even though it says they went... Oh, okay. So you're suggesting even though it says they were translated to heaven, it doesn't necessarily mean they went to heaven.
Right.
It just means they were taken up into the air and probably, died or not? Because it says Enoch didn't see death, doesn't it?
Yeah. And this is where it gets kind of fun, interesting. I don't know the answer to it really well because the two witnesses of Revelation, some people think that it might be Enoch and Elijah, some say Moses and Elijah.
I'd say Moses and Elijah, given okay. what it says in Zechariah about the two anointed ones who stand mm-hmm. either side of the Lord.
Yeah.
And then you see that in the Mount of Transfiguration. I don't right. know. That's just my...
And that also because they represent the law and the gospel. Law and the prophets. So that could be a good case. Another argument is that it's really Enoch and Elijah because neither one of them have, so to speak, died. And
right.
it's appointed once you know, to die. And so they'll come back and then they'll proceed to die as they're killed. We're just talking ideas.
Yeah.
But, I don't know. So
basically, if they didn't die, if they didn't see death, either one of them, mm-hmm. they couldn't have gone to Hades. Would that be fair to say?
What do you mean by Hades?
Well, the place of the departed spirits.
Abraham's
bosom, for one.
Well, I don't have any problem. It doesn't tell us, but I don't have any problem at all with God just taking them up in heaven, so to speak, dissolving their body, and then they go to be with the Lord, okay? I don't have a problem with that at all. It doesn't bother me.
All right, because the reason why I'm asking is I thought this would be a really good verse to use on a Jehovah's Witness. And then I realized, looking at John 3:13, that there's a part of this that's just going to get really complicated for them and for me explaining it. So,
well, that's not an argument I would use, because it does get rather ambiguous about some things. And so, it's just not necessary to go into that area. I like to do the things that are more solid, because you could argue this even with Christians and not really get anywhere.
Yeah. I spoke to I was speaking to a couple of Jehovah's Witnesses about a couple of weeks ago, and I suddenly realized while I was watching it was actually Clash of the Titans, and you know, the whole Greek mythology thing, and there's a character in there called Hades, and I suddenly realized whilst watching it that's actually a really good argument to use if you consider Luke 16, is it 19 to 32, the story of Lazarus and the rich man. The question that I had for these Jehovah's Witnesses is, why would the New Testament writers reference a term which in the Greek culture is exclusively used for the underworld? My understanding is in the Greek there is a separate word for grave, as in tomb, and that's menemion. Would I be correct in that assumption?
You know more about that one than I do right now.
Yeah, I looked it up, and whereas in the Old Testament, the concept of the pit and the concept of the common grave is represented by one word, which is Sheol. Mm-hmm. In the New Testament, it's represented by two. That concept is represented by two, Hades and Menemion. So I asked this guy this question. Why do you think the New Testament writers would reference a concept of Hades from Greek culture when they know full well that people reading that are going to assume that they're talking about spirits going to the underworld? And this guy it really stumped him. And I realized what an absolutely powerful argument that is.
That is a good argument. I like that.
So if there's anyone talking to Jehovah's Witnesses who wants to make a breakthrough, I'd suggest using that. Because, I mean, you get to a real impasse where you can show in the Old Testament and the New Testament verses that show consciousness in the place known as Sheol. And you can also show them show that there's sleep in the place known as Sheol. And it's only in the New Testament that you can really differentiate between the two. And I just got to a real impasse with these guys. And I showed him that verse from Lazarus and the Rich Man. I just asked him to explain what was going on. And I asked him to explain why that word was used as opposed to the Greek word for tomb, menemion. And he just had no answer. He was just absolutely blown away by it. So I would suggest using that in the future.
That's good. I'm looking for the word Hades there. And in Hades, verse 23.
That never means common grave. Right. Would I be right in assuming that? It always means the underworld.
I'm not going to say yes or no, because when it says always means there can't be an exception. I haven't researched that. But that's a very good point. And tying it into a different culture and a different, it's a Greek idea.
Yeah.
Why would he do that? That's a very good thing. I'm going to check it into it. I'm going to look into it.
Yeah, the other point is also where the, I think it's Acts 2:27-32, where it quotes the Psalm 16:10. It talks about you won't leave my soul in Hades. If we understand that the soul departs from the body at death, and I think even a Jehovah's Witness will agree to that, why would you associate a soul with the common grave? And I put that to them as well, and they had no answer to it. So so I think these are two pretty decent arguments to use. So
tell me that second one again.
Yeah, in Acts 2:27-32, where Luke is quoting Psalms 16:10. you won't leave my body in Hades.
Right.
My flesh won't see corruption, etc., etc.
Mm-hmm.
Are you familiar with that?
Yeah, oh yeah, yeah, yeah. Keep going.
Well, do Jehovah's Witnesses believe, as we do, that the soul doesn't reside in the body when it's dead?
Right.
So when somebody dies, except
they
the
believe
soul
that
leaves.
The body and the soul basically are kind of one and the same, and when the body dies, the soul ceases.
Right, that's right. So I showed them that verse, and I said, well, if Hades simply means the common grave, why would that soul be associated with that body after death? Because this is clearly a reference to Jesus while he's dead.
And consciousness.
In his resurrection,
right?
In his crucifixion. And they just stared at it, and they were just like, yeah, actually, we don't have an answer to that. So I think that's a fairly useful argument. I don't know what you think about this.
I'd like you to email both of those to me at Carm.
I will.
Seriously.
What's the address there?
Just carmstuff@yahoo.com. Email them to me, because those are the kind of arguments I like to go through, read some scriptures, do a little bit of research. And I know, because I'm so busy, you know, doing the radio, and then I got to pick up my kid at martial arts, then I got to go home, I have a phone meeting tonight. By the time all that's done, I'm going to forget everything.
Cool.
And
I'll do that.
I'm always looking for new and good arguments from people who do this kind of stuff too. So good stuff, man. I like that.
Cool. Well, one quick question for you. What do you know about soul ties?
Soul ties? That's when you get really upset, tied in a knot on the inner man? I don't know.
Well, my pastor said, I have a bit of, let's just say I have a bit of past as a ladies man, and he assumed, obviously, that, you know, with all the stuff that goes with that, you know, the mm-hmm. sexual mm-hmm. history as well, which is correct. And he said to me something about having to break soul ties with the people that you've had relations with.
Oh yeah, I know what they mean. Right. Yeah, because once you bond yourself in a sexual union with someone, then there is a special bond. Yeah, I've heard of that before.
Is that biblical, or is it?
There's the case is that when you join yourself, you become one flesh.
Right.
And there's a kind of a bond. Well, that's in the context of marriage, with a vow and then the issue of physical union.
This is what I wanted to ask you about. So if you have joined yourself in one, so to speak, in that way, are you considered to be married in the eyes of God?
No. Otherwise, they wouldn't have a word for fornication and adultery.
Right, okay.
Okay?
Yeah.
So, since they do have those terms, they recognize that union outside of marriage and is condemned, obviously.
Right, okay, good. So, is there anything that biblically that I need to do to break those soul ties if I marry girlfriend?
Well, I'm not saying that those soul ties exist, but what I would do is I would just go to the Lord and just confess all your sins, including those things. List them out as detailed as you can be within reason with the Lord, and just say, Lord, these things are all sin, all forgiven by you at the cross, and that you renounce them, judge them as sin, and want nothing to do with them, and that you'd even ask the memories to be removed. Things like that.
Great.
And that's what I'd recommend.
Okay.
Okay.
Excellent. Thanks a lot for your time, Matt.
Okay. God bless, Paul.
Cheers. Bye-bye.
All right. Hey, the wonderful world of Skype. That's Paul from London. So we have somebody from Connecticut, someone from London, next caller's from Florida, and hey, this show only goes out live over the air here in Boise. And people are listening. Well, I could say that over the internet they're going. They're listening, and then people are calling back. Man, wow, the display on this phone is going berserk. It does that every now and then. All kinds of letters. It's like it's garbled gook stuff on the. I'm really handsome. What? You're saying something to the? She's waving to me. I don't know what she's saying. I always put words in her mouth when she says something to me through the glass. I can't understand what she's saying. So I just put words in her mouth because might as well. I'm really intelligent. You know, stuff like that. Oh, do the show. Oh, okay. She pointed her finger. I got that one. Hey, let's get to Edwin from Florida. Hey, Edwin, how you doing?
I'm doing fine. How are you?
I'm doing fine, man. What's up? What do you got?
Well, when the guy you were talking to before was talking about, you were explaining about the three heavens.
Yeah.
And I didn't really understand that part. Can you elaborate on that?
Sure. What I'll do is I'll go, three heavens on my website, doing a search. And what does it mean? The Bible refers to the third heaven. Here we go. All right. So you can see the scriptures, or I'll quote the scriptures. There are three heavens in Jewish cosmology, and the idea of how the Jews understood in the Bible, understood heaven. The first heaven has to do with the earth's atmosphere. For example, Deuteronomy 11:17. Then the Lord's anger will burn against you, and he will shut the heavens so that it will not rain. Okay? Deuteronomy 28:12. The Lord will open the heavens to send rain. It goes on. Acts 14:17. Yet he has not left himself without testimony. He has shown kindness by giving you rain from heaven. Okay? So that's one way the word heaven is used of the earth's atmosphere. How about this one? This is the outer space area. Psalm 19, verses 4 and 6. In the heavens he has pitched a tent for the sun. It rises at one end of the heavens and makes its circuit to the other. Or Jeremiah 8:2. They will be exposed to the sun and the moon and all the stars of the heavens, which they have loved and served. And then we had third level, 1 Kings 8:30. Then hear from heaven your dwelling place. Talking about God. Psalm 2. Verse 4, the one enthroned in heaven laughs. The Lord scoffs at them. Matthew 5:16, in the same way, let your light shine before men, that they may see your good deeds and praise your Father in heaven. So, the term heaven and heavens is used in different contexts of the earth's atmosphere, of the outer space realm, and the dwelling place of God. Okay?
So, you would say, what's his name? Elijah? Which one caught up to
heaven. It would not be the third heaven where God's dwelling place was, because the atonement had not happened, and they were not ready to be moved up into the heavenly realm. Ephesians 4 kind of talks about that. So they probably went to Abraham's bosom, spoken about in Luke 16, verses 19 through 31. Okay.
Abraham's what? I don't understand that part.
Abraham's bosom was just a phrase that they used to talk about the holding place for those who died in the faith.
Okay.
And then the theory is that Jesus, according to 1 Peter chapter 3, verses roughly 18 through 20, went and preached to those spirits in captive. There's some debates on some things there. He didn't preach the gospel. He didn't preach so they could get saved, but he informed. And then it says in Ephesians 4, when he ascended on high, he led captive a host of captives. And so basically the idea is, I kind of lean this way towards the theory that he went to Abraham's bosom and took the people who had died in the faith and ascended into the heaven with the Lord at that place, that time, since the atonement had occurred. Okay? It's all theories. We don't know for sure.
Okay,
buddy?
All right, and I have another question.
Okay.
I just want to know, what's your best way to interpret Revelation? Because there's different interpretations on how to explain the book of Revelation.
Well, I would. The best way to do it? Best way, it's easy. It's easy.
Which one?
The best way is carefully. Okay? That's what I would say. Carefully. Now, if you really want to understand Revelation, what you need to do is go through verse by verse and research in the Old Testament whatever is said. Because look at the book of Revelation as an index. Think about it that way. It's an index. It tells you what to look for in the Old Testament. And you'll find all kinds of stuff. You cannot understand Revelation properly unless you understand the Old Testament. A lot of stuff, Old and New Testament, but that's what you need to do. Now, there's what's called the heptadic pattern. Some people think that Revelation is set up in a set of repeated sevens, or seven things, and then it repeats again in seven patterns. Some think it's chronological. Some think it's not. So,
because that's what I'm learning. Like, my teacher, he's showing me how John uses the Roman, because they were ruling during the since it was written in the 90 AD. Am I correct?
That's one theory. Yeah, I think it was earlier, but anyway, go ahead.
Yeah, he was saying how that he paints that picture of Roman Empire,
yeah,
ruling, being the beast in the sea,
mm-hmm,
and the dragon, just like how the Old Testament apocalypse uses Babylonians as, you get what I'm saying?
Yeah, it's referencing a lot of stuff that was contemporary at the time, and absolutely, yes, there's a lot of that.
Okay.
Absolutely, no problem.
Okay. Like, a lot of people are believing in the rapture of us leaving the earth while the wicked stay down here, or those who believe in Jesus, and
mm-hmm,
that's very popular. I don't know how...
The rapture?
I don't know how that's the best way to...
The rapture is biblical. It's spoken of in 1 Thessalonians 4, verses 16 through chapter 5, verse 2. It's definitely spoken of, and it is a thing. We who are alive and remain shall be caught up together to meet the Lord in the air. Most people believe, in America, from what I understand, in what's called a pre-tribulation rapture. The seven-year tribulation period will begin with the rapture of the Christians up into the heavens. Now, I don't believe that. I'm post-trib rapture. I believe that we'll have to go through the tribulation. And I also believe that before that happens, the wicked are taken. Because Jesus says in Matthew 13, when he talks about the wheat and the tares, the first ones are gathered are the wicked. And he specifically says so, which is really a problem. Why is it that preachers aren't teaching this when Jesus himself interprets a parable, says what's going to happen specifically, tells us what's happening, and he says, first gather the tares, and then gather the wheat into the barn. The first one's gathered at his return of the tares, the unbelievers. And doesn't mean they're raptured into heaven. I think they're taken to Armageddon. That's the only theory I can come up with for now. But that's what it says. Hey, folks, if you don't believe me, go read Matthew 13. Matthew 13. And also, when it says two men in the field, one taken, one's left, that's not the rapture. That's the wicked being taken. Just read the context in Matthew and Luke, the chapters.
Matthew 24, right?
Matthew 24, Luke 17. And just read the context, and you'll see they even asked Jesus, where are they taken? You know, two men in the field, one taken, one's left. Where are they taken? Jesus answers, where the body is, the vultures gather. That's where they're taken. So it's not the rapture. Anyway, I'll do a study on that again sometime. Maybe tomorrow for fun. I don't know. You know, just mess people up. I do that all the time. I mess them up. I say, hey, you got 5 minutes? I'll mess you up theologically. And they'll go, okay, I challenge you. And then I do. In 3 minutes, they go, man, that was awesome. And I go, hey, I got 2 minutes left. And I mess them up in some other areas. Okay?
It's funny how they say when somebody brings out the rapture, like, where in Revelation does the word rapture even start? Like, where would you find that word rapture?
The word rapture
doesn't find it anywhere in the book.
It doesn't occur in
the
Bible.
The word rapture?
No, it doesn't occur in the Bible. The word it's a Latin word.
It's nowhere in the book of Revelation. So
right.
Like, I don't know.
Well, the word rapture does not occur in the Bible. It's just a word like the Trinity. The word Trinity does not occur in the Bible, but the concept.
Yeah, I know. Right. I know. I'm saying how to rise up. Is that anywhere in the Revelation?
Well, people go to. I don't know where they go to in Revelation. I don't have it memorized. Sorry, but you know, whatever. I'm not an eschatology expert. I'm a cult kind of guy. Okay?
I have one more question. Last one.
Real fast.
All right. What are Calvinist beliefs, like, the difference from, like, Protestant?
Calvinism is Protestantism. It is within Protestantism. I'm a Calvinist, okay? What Calvinism teaches is that that God is supreme, he's sovereign, and that man is enslaved to sin. The unbelievers are enslaved to sin, and because of that enslavement to sin, they don't seek for God, cannot seek for God, cannot freely choose God of their own sinful free wills. So God must predestine them into salvation from the foundation of the world. Those whom he predestined will be saved, those whom are not predestined will not be saved. And that Jesus only bore the sins of those who are predestined to be saved. And you can't lose your salvation because it's all set by God. Doesn't mean we don't have free will. Doesn't mean we aren't able to make choices. Doesn't mean God doesn't love people. But that's the stuff that a lot of people don't like. So, and what it really means is they don't like God's sovereignty and man's depravity.
So wouldn't that be more like foreknowledge than predestined?
Nope, because when the word foreknowledge is used in the context of predestination, in Romans chapter 8, verse 29 and 30, what it says is, those whom he foreknew, he also predestined to become conformed to the image of his son. If he foreknew everybody who ever lived and knew what choices they were going to make, then that would mean God was learning. That can't be the case. And it would also mean, of all that he looked in the future to see who'd pick him, some he predestined. That's what the implication is of how people mean those words when they say he looked in the future, he had foreknowledge, and then predestined the ones who are going to choose him. What they're saying is, he looked in the future to see who's going to pick him and predestined those people. But that's not what the text says. It says, those whom he foreknew, he also predestined. They are the same group.
All right.
It doesn't say of all that he foreknew, some he predestined. It says those whom he foreknew, he also predestined. Okay?
Yeah.
Okay, man.
All right. Thank you.
Okay. We'll see you. God bless. All right, folks, if you want to call, you want a piece of me, the number is real easy. All you got to do is dial 877-207-2276. And if you're a fast listener, 877-207-2276. And if you're not a fast listener, then it's just 877, toll-free, 207-CARM on your dial. And you get right in. Let's get to Nicole from Nampa. Hey, Nicole, how are you?
Hi, Matt. I'm fine, thanks. How are you?
Doing well. How's your little one?
He's good. He's talking and being a defiant little 2-year-old.
Yeah, well, you know, talk to Nick. She can help you with some of that stuff. He's a good kid. Is he listening?
No, he's not listening. I kind of turned the radio down so that you wouldn't hear backbeat in the phone.
I was gonna say, hi, Azrael. How are you? And all that, because he loves me. He thinks I'm great.
Yeah, he does.
I'm wonderful. That's right. Okay. All right. So
anyway,
what's up?
I'm calling because I wanted to finish up Emily's second question. She got stage fright, radio fright. Which is not a slight on her. I had that the first time I called too. But in light of all your heaven talk, I thought I'd have you talk about hell a little bit. Her question was, considering how short our lives are, why is hell eternal? She doesn't think it's fair.
Oh, okay.
And I explained to her about Jesus and, you know, his propitiation and God's wrath and all that different stuff and why salvation, you can't lose it, so why would we lose hell if we're not redeemed? And I tried to talk about all that, but I thought it might be better coming from you.
Okay, no problem. Is she in the room, the chat room? Is she listening?
She's
right
not
now?
In the chat room, but she is listening.
Okay, good. Okay, here's the answer. Look, if I were to walk up to, say, your husband and just kind of slap him upside the head, he might look at me and go, hey, what was that for? Okay?
Maybe.
Maybe, yeah. And so, you know, the idea is, okay, now what if I walked up to the President of the United States and did the exact same thing? Federal offense, jail time, right?
Yes.
The exact same offense gets a different result depending on who it's against. And even though the slap was just momentary, little bitty slap, the offense or the result is totally different, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So if I slapped your husband, you know, he might take a swing back at me. He might just, you know, back up and go, what was that, dude, or what was going on? But, you know, and there's no law broken. I mean, whatever, he's a real man. He'd take it. And, you know, but the prez, you know, the president, you do that, then automatically laws get in there and there's a big judgment. Okay. So when we sin against an infinitely holy God. And he's way above the president. So we're, in a sense, slapping God. We're saying, hey, what you're saying is wrong, God. It's okay to lie. It's okay to cheat. It's okay to steal. And God says, don't, you know, thou shalt not. So we're breaking his law. That's a sin. We've insulted the infinitely holy God. Therefore, there's an infinitely intense, long consequence because of who it's against. That's the answer.
Okay.
All right?
It was a lot more simple, I guess, than I made it. But she likes the deep answers, so I gave her a deep one. And then she was like, no, I don't know about that.
Well, the
She's
deep
probably
one...
going to be like, I don't know about Matt's answer either.
Well, that's
she can call in again if she wants to.
That's a good answer, though. It is. It makes sense. I mean, if God's infinite and you insult an infinite being, how are you going to undo that?
Well, I was thinking, because heaven is eternal, why would hell not be?
Well, because our nature is eternal. Once we're made in the image of God, we're going to live forever. Now, unless she wants to say that, you know, we get out of hell after a while, then that's salvation by works. We suffer, we get it taken care of, and then we get to go be with the Lord because of our suffering. Salvation by works. That's a heresy.
That would be kind of Catholic.
Oh, boy, what an interesting concept. Hey, that's called purgatory. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. That's right. Uh-huh.
Okay. Well, that's it.
Okay.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Have a good one.
All right. We'll see you. Okay. All right. What am I going to do now? There's no calls waiting, no Skype. Is there any Skype stuff? Paul from London says the word for being caught up is harpazo. Yeah, I know that. And it's not rapture. Rapturo is Latin, I believe. But harpazo. That's what, isn't he one of the Marx brothers, harpazo? That's a joke. You don't even know who the Marx brothers are, do you? You don't? Jeez. Oh, how old are you? Two? Wait, 28? 29? 30? Uh-oh, I'm in trouble. I was too high. Jeez, you're 20, around 25. Oops. I'm going to get an arm hit for that one. So that was a nice digression. Yeah, so harpazo, you know, Harpo Marx, that was a joke. Alex says hello. Her husband's on the cell phone. She's talking to him. Like, hey, Alex, how you doing? Hey, how's it going? All right, now, if you want to call 877-207-2276, I've got Rob Bell's book in my hand. Each day I bring it in here, hoping to be able to tackle this thing again. I'm going to try and finish this tonight, tomorrow night, something like that. And how do you spell it? Look, Psalm says in the room, how do you spell it? I-T, that's how you spell it. People say to me, how do you spell that? T-H-A-T, why? That's how I spell it. I get an arm hit for that from my wife. All right, now look, Rob Bell, New Age, I mean not New Age, I want to say New Age, but Emerging Church Dude, his book, Love Wins, Truth, and I want to put Love Wins, but when I do the article, probably Love Wins, Truth Suffers, or something like that. You know, not that it dies, but he's got a lot of truths in the Bible, it's in his book, it's just that he messes up. I got his book, I'm going to continue with it. I only have a few minutes, maybe five. So I want to go through, start reading through, commenting on his book because no one's calling me right now, and that's okay. And I've been wanting to do this anyway. Here's the book. Listen. Right there. See it? Now, wait. It's on the table. Hardback. This is on page 105. I haven't even looked at this in a while. It's underlined, so I don't even know what I'm going to say. Don't even know what I'm reading. Let's see if it's any good. And so a universal hug fest where everybody eventually ends up around the heavenly campfire singing Kumbaya with Jesus playing guitar sounds a lot like fantasy to some people. Yeah, it does. And he goes down another paragraph. Others hold this perspective that there is this lifetime and only this lifetime in which we all choose one of two possible futures. But they suggest a possibility involving the image of God in each of us. You know, save it. I'm going to compare him to somebody in a minute. Next page, 106, he says, Reformation wrote to Hans von Reckenberg in 1522 about the possibility that people could turn to God after death, asking, who would doubt God's ability to do that? Again, a good question. And he goes on, he says, on page 106, he says, and so space is created in this who would doubt God's ability to do that perspective for all kinds of people, 15-year-old atheists, people from other religions, and people who rejected Jesus because the only Jesus they ever saw was an oppressive figure who did anything but show God's love. CRB's implication is that these poor people will really not go to hell. What I was going to say, Rob Bell is the master of the interrogative. Now, an interrogative is a question. A declarative is a statement, okay? So, or an indicative. Anyway, so an interrogative, you interrogate somebody. You ask them questions, the interrogative, the master of interrogative. Well, I was listening to a debate between Eddie Tabosh, an atheist, and Greg Bonson. He was a great apologist, Christian guy. And when I debated Eddie Tabosh a year and a half or so ago, I did research on him. I listened to some of his debates. And Eddie Tabosh, nice guy. I mean, I actually like him. He's an atheist. We talked before our debate, and, he's a nice guy. I'd do dinner with him, But the thing is this. He also is a master of the interrogative. And I was reminded of the atheist Eddie Tabash when I was reading Rob Bell's book. Now, here's the thing about asking questions that you don't answer. You could ask all kinds of questions. Let me give you an example. See, say my wife and I are having a discussion, and I say things like, where were you today? Why is it I couldn't get a hold of you on the cell phone? Is there a reason? How come you didn't pick up when I was calling three times? I'm not. My wife doesn't do that. I'm just saying, you see, what would the implication be? What's going on? I'd say, what's going on that you don't want to talk to me? What's going on, dear? Where have you been? You know, you could say, she might say, what are you implying? I'm not implying anything. I'm just asking questions. Well, the tone has a lot to do with it, and I could be implying all kinds of stuff. When you ask a series of questions, the implied answers or the suspicion of the answers, even though they're not addressed, kind of lends a person's mind to towards a certain or forces them to lean a certain direction. Will God really leave people in hell for eternity? The implication is, well, I guess he wouldn't, but doesn't really say it. This is what happens in the book. Now, when I teach, I ask a question and answer the question. I don't answer every question, don't have every answer right. But I mean, what if my kids say, Dad, what's wrong with the computer? What makes you think something's wrong with the computer? Dad, it's not working. The light's not on. What makes you think it's a call to light? Dad, would you stop that? Why shouldn't I answer questions with questions? You know, after a while, they walk away. We got 1 minute? Oh, I'm out of time. Oh, it's all right. Oh, it's doggy. Hey, I like this in the chat room. I think Matt is still hurting for the beating he took yesterday. You mean the atheist guy who self-destructed? Yeah. See, there's another example, as I was saying earlier in the show, how atheists think they're great. Even when they get beat, they claim victory. Hey, folks, look, I'm teaching a Bible study tomorrow night in Nampa, and if you guys, anybody's interested, we're doing an unusual Bible study. People are going to be teaching me a little bit to study tomorrow night, 7:30, and if you are interested, hey, feel free to come in. Everybody's welcome. No big deal. All you got to do is take the 84 freeway out there to Nampa. Oh, hey, it'll be tax day. Oh, April 15th. Anyway, take the freeway out there to Nampa, go out there and exit 36, go north 3/4 mile on the right. On the left-hand side is the Crossing Church. I'll be there tomorrow night, 7:30 p.m., Lord willing. God bless everybody. We'll see ya. Bye.
Has been Faith and Reason with Matt Slick. For more, go to carm.org. That's carm.org.